Now to Alton Brown, one of America's best-known food personalities. He's the host and creator of Good Eats, the Food Network's scientific cooking show.
Ever wonder why cutting an onion can feel like a tear gas attack?
He's because the host of the competitive cooking show, Iron Chef America.
I want a cheesy!
And he stars in a program about eating on the road called Feasting on Asphalt.
To be honest, what I'm in the mood for is a truck stop.
In 2007, Brown and his crew spent 26 days on the road looking for local color and good road food. They traced the Mississippi River north from the Gulf of Mexico to its headwaters in Minnesota. The adventure was aired on the Food Network last fall. Now Brown has published a companion book about the journey, Feasting on Asphalt, The River Run is part cookbook, part diary, and part memoir. And here to talk about it is Alton Brown. Alton, what a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk.
Okay, you and your nine buds have motorcycles and said, hey, I know what, let's go up the Mississippi River.
Well, the Mississippi is really America's original highway. We would not be what we are without the Mississippi. So we had done one Feasting on Asphalt already where we had crossed the country from east to west. So the natural thing to do was to go north to south or south to north up this amazing highway that really is kind of the aorta of America.
You started in New Orleans. I mean, please, you know, again.
Well, we started all the way at the very, very, very end of the river at Head of Passes, which is, you know, practically halfway out in the Gulf, quite a bit south of New Orleans to really get the full trip.
What'd you have to eat?
You know, there's not a lot to eat down there because there's still not a lot there. We ate at one place that was a little barbecue joint on the side of the road that had kind of rebuilt, you know, and the people that were working there were living in FEMA trailers and, you know, getting up early in the morning and starting the barbecue and baking biscuits. And it was a really good send-off for the trip because we were really kind of looking for tradition and nostalgia in a place where it had all been wiped away.
On your trip through Louisiana toward Mississippi, you stopped at, is it Kleibert's Turtle and Alligator Tours?
Yeah, and it's basically, oh man, Kleibert takes us inside this fence where this giant pond is and leaves us there. he leaves us. And to go off to get frozen Nutra, which is the little rodent that they feed to the alligators. And, you know, I'm standing on this concrete kind of ramp, you know, as these dinosaurs essentially start kind of lumbering up because they assume that I've brought something to eat. You know, those things can move very quickly when they get a mind to.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to face it because, I mean, we eat them, right? And,
yeah.
And how often do you get to face something that we eat that could eat you?
That's true.
So, you know, face to face with a big reptile that you intend to eat, I felt that was necessary.
Tell us about the face a guy made when you were on the road that you told him you were going north and he basically said, you know, why?
Yeah.
Why are you going outside Louisiana?
Why would you do that?
Yeah.
He snorted. It was kind of, there's nothing up there. You know, he really did believe that beyond the northern border of Louisiana, all worthwhile food ceased to exist. Of course, that wasn't the case.
Right.
But the people in Louisiana certainly seemed sure of it.
You moved across the border into Mississippi and you had catfish given with spaghetti?
Yeah. And I, you know, ignorant white boy, I guess. I had not heard of spaghetti catfish dinners and didn't put together why that combination would be potent. And, of course, it's potent because it's cheap. Catfish is plentiful, and spaghetti in large amounts is very simple to make and very inexpensive.
What are culicles? Is that how I pronounce it?
Culicle, yeah.
Culicles,
you
Mississippi.
Nailed it, culicle. The first time I locked eyes on a culicle, I thought I was looking at something like a preserved armadillo spleen because I had never seen a dill pickle pink. So my brain immediately did not say, that's a pickle. I thought, that's an organ, you know, something. But it's basically a kosher dill that has been re-cured in a souped-up Kool-Aid solution. This sounds hideous. It is refreshing, sweet and tart, you know, sour, salty. It's fantastic.
Barbecue. I mean, you really traveled south to north, mm-hmm. eating barbecue along the way. Is there one standout?
Yeah, it would be Prince Barbecue, and I'm trying to remember the
Bardwell, Kentucky.
Yeah, the really groovy thing about this place was they only make so much because it's this one guy who's making this, and people were driving in, and we had taken the last of the barbecue, and I'd see them go up to the little booth, and they'd have a few words with them, and then they'd look over at us, like, I hate you, you foreigners, you know, coming in here. And I actually kind of found myself kind of turning away, you know, like, they're either going to come take my barbecue away or they hate me for having it. But the thing that I most regret about the whole trip is that they were just putting on mutton. You have no idea how difficult it is to find mutton in this country, which, of course, is sheep, that's over a year old. It's not lamb anymore. And once a week, this guy smokes for like 18 hours, several whole sides of mutton. And he only does this on Thursdays and Fridays, and he only sells it on Saturday mornings. And I wanted nothing more. We couldn't stay. We had to move on. But that would have been a real pilgrimage.
As you traveled north, how did the food change? I mean, anecdotally, one would think it would go from hot and spicy to white.
That wouldn't be an unfair analogy. What happens is that it becomes subtle. In the South, where food is fixated upon, and it's not just a point of pride, it is the primary cultural touch point. As you move north, certainly as you move into places like Missouri and Iowa, things change. But they don't just get white and mild. You just have to start looking at real subtleties. There's still a lot of flavor there. It's just not going to hit you in the head with a baseball bat the way that it does down south.
Your last place, it's too cold to camp out, so you stay at the Nordic Inn.
That's the strangest thing I have ever beheld. It was like falling into a David Lynch movie.
It's in Crosby, Minnesota.
Yeah, and I can't sum up that experience. I think that for us, part of it was fatigue. We were really rode out, you know, at this point of the game. And then all of a sudden, we're in this place where they're dressing us up as Vikings and dressing some of us up as girl Vikings, which is even more uncomfortable.
Dressing you up?
Yeah.
You allowed them to put clothes on your body?
I was just trying to get by, you know, just trying to make it through the day.
Is there footage of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's in the show, and there's some shots in the book.
But it looks like a hearty meal you had.
Yeah, it was hearty, and most certainly the strangest culinary event of my life.
You took on this trip, you wanted to take a taste of American road food. I don't know, from what you've got in your book and the show, it seems like it's in pretty good shape.
It is still there. To say that it's in pretty good shape, there are a lot of places that are barely hanging on. For instance, two of the places that we visited on the trip, Joe's White Front, which I think is in Rosedale, Mississippi, and then Bright Box in Iowa, which is the oldest restaurant in Iowa, both burned down since the show. And in the case of Joe's White Front, I doubt they even had insurance because this was subsistence, or what I call subsistence restauranting, where you're kind of just barely getting by. You're grandfathered in on 15 different things. And I imagine that place now is gone forever. So they are there, but I wouldn't say that all is well in road food. No, I wouldn't. I mean, we've got an opportunity to save it. You know, the dodo bird's not dead yet, but it's getting there.
Well, going out on the road might be a decent idea. I mean, I don't know, with the price of gas, that's going to be tough for folks to take road trips.
Well, you know, the thing, though, is if you get your head in the right place, you can drive, you know, an easy day's journey someplace and get more out of it and get more out of that tank of gas than you would, you know, flying to Disneyland. The trip in America can be the destination. So I would really like to see people get back on the road and enjoy travel for travel's sake.
Thanks a lot, Alton.
You're very welcome.
Alton Brown is a prominent personality on the Food Network. We've been talking about his book, which is based on his adventures filming the series Feasting on Asphalt. Today, he begins filming a new series, Feasting on Waves. You can find recipes for coolicles, fried pork sandwiches, and pecan coconut pie at npr.org/books.
Alita Garcia stumbled through the dense winter woods, blood marking her long path, a bright red comet trail against the blazing white snow.
That's Scott Sigler reading from his soon-to-be-released podcast novel, Infected. Scott is one of the most successful podcasting authors to date, with each of his novels hitting the number one spot for audiobooks on iTunes. Scott's in the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco to tell us more about his podcasting success. Hi there, Scott.
Hi.
Tell us, what is a podcasting novelist?
the first release of the book tends to be as a podcast, as a weekly serialized podcast. So you put out 30 to 45 minutes of the book every week. That usually runs 20 to 25 weeks, depending on how long the book is. Then when that is done, then you take the content and then you roll it out into print, if that's an option for you.
Hmm. How exactly is it done?
Well, everybody who's doing this is mostly recording at home. So it is the author is doing the reading and the recording, editing and processing the file, then putting, in effect, you're just doing a blog and you are putting an audio enclosure in each blog post. So people who subscribe to it can get it in their iTunes and it automatically shows up every week as soon as you post it. In any other blog reader or blog catcher, or what most people do is just treat it like a normal website, and they just come back every week, and they click on the little link on your website, and they listen to the episode.
How did you get to the head of the pack of all these podcasting novelists?
Was just really lucky enough to be one of the early guys doing it. My first one was called Earthcore, and because it was only available as a podcast, you couldn't go get a PDF, and you couldn't buy the book, and there was something magical about them not being able to get the story that kind of drove them a little crazy, made them enjoy it, and start to spread the word to all their friends. Since it was free audio, it just spread across the internet, and they were emailing each other and saying, check this out.
Are you making any money if you're giving away the stories for free?
You can make money. Right now, my podcast is hosted by a company called Podshow, and Podshow goes out and sells advertising against the thousands of shows they have. So it's basically the same thing as a television or radio network. It's just all online.
Is there a ripple effect when your podcast novel, Infected, gets printed?
The ripple effect is in reverse. So when the book comes out in print, I'm able to communicate with all these people who are all signed up on my website, are getting my emails, say, hey, the book's coming out. You enjoyed this. Go buy it.
It helps, though, too, when you begin, your kernel is a really good story.
If you've got a book that you feel real confident about, by all means, podcast it. But if you're halfway through your first draft, you got to remember, most people are only going to listen to you once if they don't like you, and then that's probably going to be it, and they're not going to come back.
Scott Ziegler, the hardcover version of Infected, his novel, will be released on April 1st. He joined us from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco. Scott, thanks a lot. Good luck with both of them.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
We are there. The Major League Baseball season has begun, and I don't think any sports season brings with it a more ample annual bookshelf full of new writing about a game. And it's not the kind of writing that we associate with a lot of other sports. It's not the how-to writing of, say, golfing great Tom Watson on The Short Game. Instead, it's the how-we-used-to writing on a game that is intertwined with memories of youth and even with the inherited memories of our father's youth. One addition to this year's baseball library is an anthology of essays called Anatomy of Baseball, and one of the contributors is our own Stefan Fatsis, who talks with us Fridays about sports and the business of sports, and who brings with us today the subject of his essay. Stefan, it is a thing of beauty. I want you to describe it for
Thank
us.
Thank you. It is my baseball glove.
It's beautiful.
It is 31 years old. It is a Rawlings XPG6. Dates back to the early 1960s. The first signature in the glove was Mickey Mantle's. Mine has Willie Stargell's in it, oddly enough. Stargell was a left-handed hitting first baseman when I bought the glove in 1977.
And this is not a first baseman.
And this is an infielder's glove, though it was used in the outfield by many players mm-hmm. as well.
You write in the essay, I'm going to quote, it even smells beautiful. It's the smell of leather, dirt, grass, saliva, sun, spring, childhood, summer, hope, skill, anticipation, achievement, fulfillment, memory, love, joy.
I have it on my hand right now, and it does evoke all those things. I'm smelling it. I'm pounding it.
Talk about the relationship between a boy or a child and his or her glove.
A man and his glove. And I say this without exaggeration. It's probably the most intensely felt relationship that I've had in my life.
With
an inanimate object.
You actually took it for an expert consult.
I did. I wanted to find out more about the history of my glove.
Yeah. Now, the business of manufacturing baseball gloves, like so much else, has moved to Asia over the years. But you did find this sort of master craftsman who remains in this country to be a glove expert.
Yeah, his name is Bob Clevenhagen, and he is the glove designer at Rawlings. He's only the third person in the history of Rawlings, which dates back to 1887, to hold this title. He knows everything about what makes a terrific glove, and you're right. He told me that not only has manufacturing shifted, but another thing that's shifted is quality. Gloves like the one I bought when I was 14 years old were made of a very stiff leather, Horween leather from a company in Chicago. Today's gloves are, you get them out of the box or off the shelf, and they're very floppy. They're ready to use. I had to break my glove in. This glove was one of the first modern baseball gloves. Gloves up until the late 50s were sort of shaped like your hand. Mm-hmm. They were puffy. They were awkward. This glove had a deep pocket. It was easy to manipulate. It really helped revolutionize the glove industry and baseball.
So you're saying the activity of breaking in a glove is now... it's obsolete?
Pretty much. I mean,
what do they sleep on at night? What do they put under the mattress?
I did it the old-fashioned way. I stuck it under my mattress for a few weeks and just played constantly.
You learned an important tip, what not to do with the baseball glove from the
glove
man.
Yeah, two things I learned. One was something that I did because I was emulating the pros. I spit in my glove.
Oh, my.
And Mr. Clevenhagen told me that spitting in your glove is absolutely verboten because it dries out the leather. The second thing was when I brought my glove to Cal Ripken Jr. and asked him for an appraisal, he started to slide his hand into it. And then he stopped and he said, you should never let anyone stick your hand in your glove.
Want to read one of the peons to your glove that you've included in the essay?
I spent a bit of time in the essay describing what my glove looks like. And part of it is just sort of the natural beauty of this thing. Each finger curves gently like a suburban cul-de-sac. The adjustable loops surrounding the pinky and thumb aren't tied too tightly, but their existence is palpable. The web isn't soft and deep so that a ball might get lost, but rather follows the natural curvature from the top of the index finger to the top of the thumb. The heel of my glove aligns with the heel of my palm. The shearling beneath the wrist strap is matted but still recognizable. There are no garish personal endorsements, just my first initial and last name written meticulously in black ink letters, 3/8 of an inch tall, just above the seam along the thumb. It looks as if I used a ruler to line the letters up.
And just to set the record straight, the glove we're looking at right now, it's not in its pristine condition. You had it restored.
No, pristine meaning dilapidated condition. I did send it to Bob Clevenhagen. He gave it the once over. He offered to restore it for me, and I very, very reluctantly allowed him to do so. And when the glove came back with this beautiful new, deep, rich leather on the interior and new laces and new patches, I was devastated. It wasn't my glove anymore. And it took me a while to get used to the fact that my glove had been transformed into something else. And now I really do feel it is, once again, a thing of beauty.
Okay. Stefan Fatsis talking about his glove, My Glove, a Biography, is his contribution, an essay to the new anthology, Anatomy of Baseball. Thanks a lot, Stefan.
Thank you, Robert.
And you can see Stefan's glove before and after and read part of his essay at npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Before gay became homosexual and deer became Bambi, those words had different meanings. Gay was carefree and happy. Deer referred to any four-legged land animal. Over the years, words evolve. Their meanings broaden or break down depending on how they're used in popular culture. Saul Steinmetz has spent years following the transformations of the most basic words. He's a lexicographer and dictionary editor. His new book is Semantic Antics, How and Why Words Change Meaning. Saul Steinmetz is in our New York bureau. Hello to you.
Hello.
Tell us the ways that English language words shift in meaning or in connotation.
There are many ways. One very common one is specialization. For example, girl. To us, girl means only one thing. But at one point, originally in the early Middle Ages, girl meant a young child of any sex, what we called a boy or girl.
Oh.
That was the word for girl. What they used for what we now know as a girl, there was words like maid and maiden. And as those terms became more specialized, like we know that a maid is a young girl of a certain virtue, of a certain type, so then they started using girl to mean specifically a female child.
Our language, the English language, includes so many words that we borrow from other languages. I'm thinking of pajamas and garage and shampoo. Have their meanings changed as much over the years as some of the ones we've been talking about?
The tendency is, in the English language, when you borrow a word, you usually keep the meaning the same as that of the borrowed language.
Uh-huh.
We don't change it. So garage, for example, you mentioned garage, is borrowed from French. Mm-hmm. The original meaning wasn't exactly what it is today. It was more of a hangar, like a place where you took vehicles and kept them there for a long time. It's not like the two-door garage of today.
Do you have some favorite words that have become so totally different from what they originally meant that they are unrecognizable?
Unrecognizable? Oh, my gosh. Many, many, many words. Let me think of one at least. Meticulous. Meticulous comes from Latin meticulosus, and it meant fearful, timid. And the reason it changed to mean what it is now, that is very careful and fussy, is because people who are fearful and timid tend to be very careful with what they do. And therefore, eventually, it developed into the idea of a meticulous worker is one who is extremely careful about details.
There are words that we so often misuse or misunderstand, and one that I'm thinking of is disinterested and uninterested.
It totally reversed its meaning. Today, we say that disinterested can only be applied to someone who is impartial, while uninterested means not having any interest in something. But originally, it was just the opposite. So what happened was that over the years, the meanings of these words changed around, although to this day, some people use disinterested to mean not impartial, but uninterested.
Yeah.
If you notice, the prefixes are dis and on. These prefixes are very confusing. They both mean basically a negative of some form. So if it's a negative of some form, there's no reason why people shouldn't use one instead of the other to imply negativity.
Sure.
Which is what they do, of course.
And make them interchangeable when that's not correct.
Right. Yeah. But, of course, critics will always criticize. They will write long criticisms about the misuse of these words.
And most of us will misunderstand what they've written.
Miss is right.
Thank you so much. Saul Steinmetz's new book is called Semantic Antics. Nice to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Susan.
You can read about how words like wallop, weird, and worry have changed meanings over the years at npr.org/books.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. Tomorrow, Robert Mugabe faces his strongest challenge as president of Zimbabwe, a country that he has ruled or misruled since independence 28 years ago. His opponents say that he'll try to rig the vote. He says they're lying. Mugabe's story is much more complicated than, say, that of Idi Amin. As an independence fighter, he was made of much more substantial stuff than mere bluster. He was a fiercely intelligent spokesman for his cause. In prison, he had earned a string of degrees by correspondence courses. When his country, which used to be Southern Rhodesia, won its independence, Mugabe was celebrated as an African liberation hero, a character who foreshadowed the role that Nelson Mandela would play in neighboring South Africa. But Mugabe's rule has been ruinous for his country's economy, thuggish at times, and it has been, above all, seemingly endless. Heidi Holland has written a book that's been published in South Africa, not here yet, a book that explores what makes this man tick. It's called Dinner with Mugabe. And Heidi Holland, you should explain the title, since the book is really framed by two meetings with Mr. Mugabe.
Yes, I met him first in 1975 when I was a journalist but also an activist. He came to meet somebody else at my house. He didn't come to see me. I was just there providing a safe place and a dinner. He came late and then he kept looking at the clock because he had to be at the station at 9 o'clock. And eventually I suddenly realized that I would have to drive him to the station. My friend, the constitutional expert he'd come to see, couldn't drive. I had a baby asleep in his crib, so I drove him at breakneck speed to the station and said to him, look, I'm sorry I'm driving so fast, but I left my baby at home alone. And he clucked a bit and carried on talking with Arne in the back seat, this friend of mine. And then to my astonishment, he rang the next afternoon from a public call box and said, thanks for dinner, and was your baby all right? So over the years, I always had this a rather different perception of Robert Mugabe than a lot of people around me, and that I knew he was a decent guy. And then recently, 3 months ago actually, just before Christmas, I finally met him again and had a long interview with him, certainly long by by the normal standards, because he doesn't actually grant any interviews at all. 2.5 hours I spent with him for the book that I had meanwhile been researching, to try and find out what happened to this man. And that's what I discussed with him in the meeting just before Christmas.
Your inquiry was as much or even more psychological than political, merely. What in the end do you conclude? What is it about Robert Mugabe could have the clay of his feet rise well up his stature?
He is a weak guy. I worked with three psychologists to interpret the fresh material I was getting from the interviewees, people who'd had dealings with him. And the conclusion was really very interesting. First of all, he came from a very, very deprived background. And he was a very shy little boy. He's still shy, actually, quite noticeably so. Even though the film clips you see of him waving his fist in the air, it's obviously his public face. And he is really friendless. As a child, even, he didn't play with other kids. In the interview with him a few months ago, he agreed that he lived mainly in his head, always had done. He always had a book. He said he liked to talk to himself, to recite little poems, he said. A very lonely figure, really. I don't think I've ever met anybody who comes across as such a lonely figure. And as a result, he's really also quite aloof, cold. And I think over the years, because he lived in a bit of a fantasy world as a child, being such a loner, he's had a very impractical take on his role as head of state in Zimbabwe.
You're saying that bookish childhood, that resort to fantasy early on in life, paved the ground for an adult capacity for denial about what's been going on in Zimbabwe in recent years.
Yes, well, certainly he's in denial now. But in the meantime, he also lacked the capacity to cope with disillusionment. There were various moments when he was sorely challenged, as one would be in politics, you know, sooner or later. One was in the white Rhodesians, as they were, voted against him after 5 years. They were guaranteed 20 seats by the British at Lancaster House.
That was the independence conference that ended the war in Rhodesia, as it was.
Exactly. After 5 years, they were invited to vote. And at that time, Robert Mugabe had gone to extraordinary lengths to keep the whites happy because they controlled the economy to a large extent. And then, to his astonishment, they voted for Ian Smith, his arch enemy and his forerunner. That was, I think, one of the pivotal moments. He was very disillusioned. He was hurt, actually. But more than that, he was angry.
And felt terribly rebuffed then by Britain, unable to adapt creatively to that challenge. I recently asked Archbishop Desmond Tutu what he made of Mugabe's career, and he suggested that, perhaps I had mentioned the comparison with Nelson Mandela, as I remembered Mugabe when he first was president of Zimbabwe. And Tutu suggested perhaps Mugabe had felt terribly upstaged by Mandela, and that that experience could have been very embittering for him. Do you buy that?
Yes, I do. I think he was very jealous of Mandela because he had been the darling of Africa up to that point. Mugabe is very, very well developed intellectually, but not emotionally. Mandela was so much more relaxed. You know, Mandela had charisma of a real warm kind, and I think Mugabe deeply resented this. I think it was probably a sort of sibling rivalry that he perceived.
There's just one exchange from your lengthy interview with Mugabe that I'd like you to recount. It's when he's actually telling you, and you're being pretty challenging with him, and he's telling you that actually the economy of Zimbabwe is excellent, and it's better than other countries in Africa. He's talking about the mines, he's talking about farms. The only thing missing, he says, is products in the stores for people to buy. It's an extraordinary comment.
Yes, well, that's when I knew that he was completely deluded. I mean, it was just so obvious then. It had been obvious earlier on when he made comments like he doesn't make enemies, other people make him an enemy of theirs and so on. But once he made light of the fact that there were no goods to buy on the shelves, it was completely clear that he was deluded. And yet when I said that to the priest who had organized the interview for me, I said to him, the president is very deluded about the economy. And he said, yes, well, that's because people don't tell him the truth, which is just not the right answer. The answer is you can't tell Mugabe the truth. He's deluded now to such an extent, and he's positioned himself in such a way, in a bubble, where nobody can tell him the truth. You know, he can't be wrong. He can only be right. So he really does live a very, very detached life now.
It's Heidi Holland, whose book Dinner with Mugabe has been published in South Africa. She's talking with us from Johannesburg. And I gather the book is available online, but not in bookstores in the U.S.?
It's available on www.dinnerwithmugabe.com.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. Goodbye.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Just ahead, the Barbershop Guys on politics and, what else, sports. But first, each week we explore issues of spirituality in our segment Faith Matters. Today we want to talk about fundamentalism, specifically Christian fundamentalism. I think it's fair to say that many of us think we know who and what a fundamentalist is. Militant, uncompromising, somebody who brooks no argument. But to Brett Granger, fundamentalists are none of that and all of that. He captures the complexities in his new book, In the World But Not Of It, One Family's Militant Faith and the History of Fundamentalism in America. In it, he tells the story of his family and of others throughout the U.S. who have chosen to live their lives following the ardent word of God. Brett Granger joins me now from member station WGBH in Boston. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Michelle.
In your book, you start out calling fundamentalism the F word, which is not what most of us think is the F word. What are you getting at here?
You know, fundamentalists themselves have a very interesting relationship with fundamentalism. When the word was first coined in the 20s by a Baptist minister named Curtis Lee Laws, he meant it in a very positive sense. Fundamentalist was someone willing to fight for the faith. So basically what I'm charting in this course is the shift away from fundamentalism as a word itself. Those initial positive connotations became identified after 25 with belligerence, intolerance, all kinds of backwardness and so on. And so eventually you get to the 50s and 60s where evangelists such as Billy Graham, you know, got rid of the word altogether. He didn't really stop being a fundamentalist in terms of what he believed, but he wanted to get along with American culture. He wanted to basically focus on saving souls, and so he lost that sort of tone that we identify with fundamentalists in the 70s.
Why are you bringing it back?
Why am I bringing it back? Uh-huh. My point in trying to continue to use it is that I think when we call everybody an evangelical, we lose a certain amount of descriptive power. I think it's fair to say that all fundamentalists are evangelicals, but not all evangelicals are fundamentalists.
Mm-hmm, that's well said. You've mentioned, obviously, you have a master's in divinity, right? So you've studied, mm-hmm. and you've studied fundamentalism in a global context. But in the Christian context, are there core beliefs that define fundamentalism in the U.S.?
I think you could still say that the original five fundamentals of faith that were hammered out in the late 19th century still hold today. But I actually feel that the doctrinal stuff is less important than the kind of approach they take to being in the world but not of it. George Marsden put it very well when he said, you know, a fundamentalist is an evangelical with an attitude.
And when you say attitude, you mean like a tood.
Exactly. They're angry. You know, they're upset. They got something to say. I think when you think of Billy Graham, you don't think of someone who's angry at America. You know, he wants to spread the gospel. And to do that, I think he toned down the tood. And that's how he reached so many people.
What do you think is the biggest misconception that many people have about fundamentalists in the U.S., Christian fundamentalists mm-hmm. in the U.S.?
I think there's this assumption that they all agree, you know, within themselves. I think that's a great misconception. You know, the fundamentalists that I grew up with, they weren't interested in world domination. They just wanted to be left alone. They didn't even vote. You know, to vote was to be complicit in the world. It was to be sort of contaminated by the things of the world.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News, and I'm speaking with author Brett Granger about his new book, In the World But Not Of It. It's a memoir and a history of fundamentalism in the U.S. Tell me about your family.
Oh, my family. Well, my family on both sides were members of the Plymouth Brethren, which is this very small, militant group of fundamentalists that were founded in the 19th century. I sort of had a unique experience in that, you know, while I swam in this sea of fundamentalist faith, On the other hand, I kind of emerged from it relatively untouched. And part of the reason for that, I think, is because, you know, both my parents were sort of black sheep in their family. And so by the time I was coming up, you know, participation was mandatory, but I didn't get the kind of, you know, guilt from my parents that a lot of my friends did. So in some ways, I was kind of in the brethren, but not of them. I definitely imbibed the worldview, but when it came time for me to leave, I didn't feel burned by the tradition. I felt very much like I was taking away the pluses and sort of escaping some of the more constricting aspects of the faith.
You write a wonderful section about your grandparents waiting for the rapture, which I have to say I found hilarious and touching at the same time. But explain, first of all, what the rapture is and why are they waiting for it. And I think I may have you read a section about that too, but set it up for us. Explain, what's the rapture? And
sure.
Why were they waiting for it? Mm-hmm.
So the rapture is this belief that Jesus will return imminently in secret for all the true believers. So, you know, obviously the second coming is a very old Christian doctrine, but what's special about the rapture is that it kind of breaks up the second coming into two events. So you've got this first second coming when Jesus returns and secretly kind of gathers up all the believers and, you know, they'll leave behind all their little piles of clothes and glasses and stuff. And then there's the second coming 7 years after that when he comes back real kind of public and carrying a big stick and he beats up all the bad guys. He
swaggers into town.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's high noon.
Mm-hmm. So the trick here is that they had actually identified the day when this was going to happen.
The reason my grandfather got wrapped up in this was because he'd read a pamphlet by Edward Weisenant, who's a former NASA engineer who'd gotten into, you know, the Bible and done some number crunching and come up with a date for the rapture, which he pinpointed in 1988. So my grandfather, who was a lay evangelist, got very involved in spreading this within the brethren. And he, you know, there was a day in October that he actually spent, you know, sitting in the living room with my grandmother waiting for this to happen.
And this was so controversial that members of his congregation literally asked him not to come to church that day because they didn't want to hear all about this. They thought, you know, let's just keep this under wraps, buddy. And, you know, can I ask you to read this section, a little section from the book where they're waiting?
Sure. Mm-hmm. So I'll just set this up. This is my grandfather in the living room on the day when he's waiting for the Lord to return. He read to comfort himself. Then he prayed. He prayed for his six children and for their families, for the grandchildren who were still dead in their sins, that the Spirit would strive with them, roiling the waters of the heart until they acknowledged their utter depravity and professed their faith in the cross of Jesus Christ, in the bloodshed at Calvary. He prayed for the Lord's glorious appearing, for the rapture of the saints, for the promise of a new heaven and a new earth. My grandmother played a hymn at the organ, then, feeling restless, took up her knitting. An old clock ticked away the countdown. She paused in mid-stitch, displeased to realize that she would be leaving a work half finished. Setting aside her needles, she resolved to make some last-minute phone calls to loved ones. One of the calls was to my mother. My grandmother told her that we should help ourselves to her homemade preserves and ginger cookies. "We won't be needing them," she said gaily. This upset my mother. As she later pointed out, it insinuated that our family would be stuck with last summer's chutney while the saints feasted in glory.
And needless to say, perhaps not needless to say, the rapture did not come that day. Was this a crisis for the family?
It was more a social crisis than a crisis of faith. I don't think my grandfather ever once doubted his faith, even after this, you know, this calamity. But certainly in terms of the community we were a part of, it's a tiny little community, and certainly it was very difficult for us to show our faces at church for some time.
One of the things I like about the book is that you don't shy away from the fact that for some people, what is obvious and true and possible to others suggests mental illness, you know, visions, you know, and I'd like to ask how you, as you became an adult, kind of grappled with the fact that for some, you know, some people, real possibilities, the real possibility, you know, of heaven on earth, of being kind of restored to glory and so forth, for some people really is a sign that there's something wrong. And for some people, it's just a very deep belief. Do you know what I mean? Could you talk about that?
There's all kinds of things that we do that don't make any sense. You can find, you know, someone who doesn't believe in God but avoids, you know, stepping on cracks in the sidewalk. That's just as irrational to me as to believe that, you know, some guy 2,000 years ago died and was buried and resurrected. Just because, you know, fundamentalists wait for Jesus to come again doesn't mean that they're working out some kind of mass cultural neurosis or mental illness.
Well, it is interesting to contemplate. I think it is an 18th century Enlightenment conceit that if we are presented with the same facts, we will all come to the same conclusion.
Mm.
And that's clearly not the case. But what do you make of the fact that fundamentalism persists in a modern, technologically rich world where we don't have the isolation of sort of geographic boundaries, of sort of minimal communication tools and things of that sort? You know, what do you make of it?
For one, it says something about the enduring appeal of strong militant faith. I think, you know, the fact that these are the churches that continue to grow while, you know, the liberal mainline churches continue to shrink, I think there's obviously something that these communities are offering people that they're finding that they're not finding in the liberal mainline denominations.
One of the other questions I have, and particularly because you are a student of fundamentalist movements around the world, is that many Americans have this notion that fundamentalism thrives overseas in countries that are poor and frustrating, right? Mm. In which particularly young people have a difficult time advancing, and that this provides them an outlet for their desire for meaning. But that isn't the case in the U.S. The U.S. is still a rich country. There are people in this country who are not, you know, well off. But in global terms, we are very well off. So again, another question about why you think, is it just that we're so wrong about the rest of the world, or is it there's something that we're not getting about the meaning, the riches, the attraction of fundamentalism?
I think this is a very comfortable, you know, liberal explanation for fundamentalism to say, oh, well, you know, these poor people are down on their luck. The world's not going their way, and so this is the only option they have to turn to this faith. That's kind of patronizing to me. I think, you know, there are good reasons often why people choose to become fundamentalists, and, you know, it behooves us to listen to some of those before we pass judgment.
Finally, I wanted to ask about you and your own struggle to find your place in the world spiritually. You talk about the fact that you were always kind of questioning. Your parents had been sort of questioners. You questioned, and that by your teens you'd fallen away from the Plymouth Brethren. But as an adult, there was a void. We talk about that and how you reconciled the worlds in which you have one foot in both.
I didn't have a hard time leaving the Brethren, but what I discovered was that, you know, the Brethren had a hard time leaving me. I think, you know, one thing that I had difficulty shedding was this idea that in evangelical circles that you're sort of called out of the world. And, you know, all I wanted to do in high school was to be in the world and to belong. And after a while, I guess I sort of discovered that belonging wasn't all it was cracked up to be. I still feel very much like there are these parts of myself that, you know, in one part I'm this kind of modern person who believes in evolution and believes that the world runs a certain way. And in another part of me, you know, I believe all kinds of other things that don't make a lot of sense as a modern, rational, you know, Western person. And I don't expect to work that out. I'm happy to live with the contradictions and to try and live in the space between them.
Brett Granger is the author of In the World But Not of It, One Family's Militant Faith and the History of Fundamentalism in America. He joined us from member station WGBH in Boston. Brett Granger, thank you so much for talking to us.
It was my pleasure.